Turn to chapter 16, and we're going to pick up where we left off. We actually left off in verse 15. So if you need a Bible, go ahead and raise your hand. These guys are coming up the aisles right now. We left off with David fleeing Jerusalem because of the rebellion of his son Absalom. Such a sin as David had with Bathsheba, the repercussions of it still boggle my mind. You know, people argue over the fact, well, gee, you know, was it right that David was such a man after God's own heart, and yet he still sinned with Bathsheba and got away with it, and God still forgave him? And when you think of what he experienced, did he really get away with it? You know, I mean, I think we have to think about that. I mean, what a costly enterprise for a few moments of pleasure. What it cost him. It's unfathomable that people could think that. So I look at where Absalom is. I look at some of the things that happened. Now, David has run. And at this point, a few of his friends are starting to align themselves with David. And picture this. I mean, in a way, one good thing about this rebellion is it really is going to show David who is who. Who are really his friends? Who are really on the Lord's side and recognize him as the king despite his failure? And who's there just lurking, looking for an opportunity for him to fall so they can promote themselves and go with another king and seek for an opportunity against him. So really, it's going to be a good lesson. It's going to choose who's who. David, we left him off as Shimei had cursed him, and I think this was probably the lowest point as he's fleeing Jerusalem, going across the Kidron River there. There's a steep valley he's going down out of the city, up Mount of Olives, and as he's fleeing, going even farther down across the Mount of Olives, down into the valley of where Jericho is in the Jordan Valley, and eventually he's going to ford the river and get across the river. But as he's been on the Mount of Olives, he's going up there at Shimei, one of these guys from a Benjamite who felt that he had dealt wrongly with Saul, has cursed him, and at this point it's David's lowest point. I think it's just a real tough thing. But meanwhile, Absalom and all the people, the men of Israel, came to Jerusalem, and Ahithophel was with them. Now, Ahithophel, remember, was David's counselor, who was one of the conspirators. And when David found that out, he said, "Oh, Lord, make his counsel foolishness," because he knew how deadly that was. He knew Ahithophel was a wise guy. He knew how to strategize. He knew David. He knew so much, and he was afraid. He wasn't so much concerned about his son figuring out how to do because, you know, David was a seasoned veteran in the affairs of war and difficulties. So he wasn't worried about Absalom. When he found out that Ahithophel was with Absalom, he really prayed, "Lord, help." Well, God is going to amazingly help. In fact, Hushai the Archite came to David after he'd found out Ahithophel was with him, with Absalom. And Hushai was basically, you know, the amazing thing, Hushai was a friend of David, and he came to join David, and David said, "You know, I think you need to go back." At this point, I think it was kind of a little bit of a turning point with David thinking about what's going to happen. Right now, at this point, he's just watching. You know, "Lord, what are you trying to do? Do you want me out of the kingdom? Do you want to kill me? Or are you using this as a lesson in my life?" You know, I mean, he's ready to submit to the will of God, whatever it might be. But as he watches, he notices that God is bringing him certain people that are key. Zadok the priest, who was a seer and a prophet also, and Hushai the Archite, who is also one of David's counselors and friends. And so he's seeing key people coming to him, and he's thinking probably to himself, "Well, maybe the Lord isn't through with me. Maybe he does have something in mind here. I want to be open." David's heart was not presumptuous. He wasn't, you know, arrogant. He wasn't fighting his own battle. He wanted to know, "Lord, what do you have in mind?" So Hushai the Archite came, and David sent him back and said, "Maybe you can, you know, counteract Ahithophel's counsel." So now we come to that place where Absalom and all the people came to Jerusalem, and Ahithophel was with him. And it was so when Hushai the Archite, David's friend, came to Absalom, that Hushai said to Absalom, "Long live the king, long live the king." Now, he's not exactly lying. He didn't say which king. You know, for all his mind, he's still praising David, but you know, Absalom thinks it's for him. So Absalom said to Hushai, "Is this your loyalty to your friend? Why did you not go with your friend?" And Hushai said to Absalom, "No, but whom the Lord and his people and all the men of Israel choose, his I will be, and with him I will remain." Notice still, he's being a little cagey. He's not saying, "I'm with you." He's not lying. You know, it's not exactly the truth either. But he's giving the impression he's with Absalom, but he's saying, "Whom the Lord and this people and all the men of Israel choose, his I will be." And I think in his own mind, the verdict was still out on that. Furthermore, "Whom shall I serve? Should I not serve in the presence of his son? As I have served in your father's presence, so I'll be in your presence." So in the capacity of counselor, he was going to serve. He wasn't lying. "I'll serve. I'm not going to tell you I'm going to give you good counsel, but I'll serve as a counselor." You know, he's thinking quick on this, you know. It's kind of like the guy who's working in the produce department, and lady comes up to him and says, "I'd like to buy half a head of lettuce." And he says, "Half a head of lettuce? Lady, God made them in whole heads. Why would we sell a half a head?" And she says, "Well, I've been chopping here for many years, and you won't sell me a half a head of lettuce?" And so he says, "Okay, I'll go talk to the manager." So he walks to the front of the store, and he says to the manager, "You know, there's this lame-brained lady back there who wants to buy a half of a head of lettuce." And at that point, the manager was kind of gesturing to him like this, because the woman had followed him up to the manager, and he didn't know that she was right behind him. And he caught the signal of the manager, and he said, "And this nice lady would like to buy the other half." Well, the manager was so impressed after the lady was gone and they got her taken care of. He said, "Man, that was pretty quick thinking. Where did you learn that?" And he says, "Hey, I grew up in Grand Rapids. The only thing in Grand Rapids is hockey teams and ugly women." And the manager looked at him and says, "Wait a minute, my wife's from Grand Rapids." And he says, "Really, what hockey team does she play for?" Little wit. You got to be quick. Well, this is where Hushai is. You know, he's playing his cards just right. You know, he's getting in there. But, you know, the amazing thing is Ahithophel was a wise counselor. And Hushai was not, you know, nearly as experienced as Ahithophel, so we still don't know what's going to happen. Well, Absalom then said to Ahithophel, "Give counsel as to what we should do." And Ahithophel said to Absalom, "Go to your father's concubines, whom he has left to keep the house, and all Israel will hear that you're abhorred by your father. Then the hands of all who are with you will be strong." So they pitched a tent for Absalom on the top of his house, the house, and Absalom went into his father's concubine in the sight of all Israel. Now, is that not exactly what Nathan the prophet told David would happen? He said, "You did it secretly with Bathsheba, but someone's going to do it openly with your wives." And here now is his concubines. They're up on the rooftop. You know, Absalom goes in. Now, this was also, there was two things in this. It was, first of all, a strong statement. When you went into the women of the previous king, basically you were basically usurping his authority. That was it. You were taking charge. It was a strong statement of treason, of setting up something new. And plus, what Ahithophel said it would do, it would make people realize that this is not just, you're not tentatively stepping and feeling things out. You're making a strong statement. It's either David or you. And Ahithophel was wise in that respect. He knew what Absalom needed to do, and it was a wise strategic maneuver. People would go, "Whoa, you know, I guess David really is out," type of thing. And it says, "The counsel of Ahithophel, which he gave in those days, was as if one had inquired at the oracle of God." Not that it was good in the sense of it being from God, but that he was wise. You know, I knew a person like this in ministry. Incredible wisdom. The guy was actually one of the pastors that assisted Raul in the days when I first started on staff and was an intern getting trained. The guy that was, he was Raul's main assistant. And I tell you, the man was incredibly shrewd and incredibly wise. I mean, he would be able to look at you and almost know what you're thinking. It was scary sometimes. You know, I'd come in late, you know, and I think no one would see me, and I'd get in there and, you know, get into the prayer meeting and be praying and being all spiritual and thinking I got away with it. And he'd come up to me afterwards and said, "Where were you?" I'd be like, "How did you see me?" You know, he'd always know exactly what was going on. that he'd always be at the right place at the right time. I could never get away with anything, you know. Not that I was trying, but every now and then I needed to. And he was shrewd. Plus, he'd always give good counsel. He could see the heart of an issue. And, you know, when you talk to him, you'd get some real solid counsel. But sadly, like Ahithophel, his heart really was not loyal. He was interested in his own desire and his own means. He would undermine Raul, and he was seeking to have a position for himself. He wanted people to look to him. Well, there was some things that I felt were not right in that sense, but I tell you, there's one thing I always respected. The guy had wisdom. Eventually, God removed him from ministry completely. It was a sad thing that happened. God removed him. He got lifted up in pride, started this whole ministry, and then eventually left, but it was not in good terms, and eventually just his life went down the hill because it was, you know, his heart was lifted up in pride. He ended up getting divorced eventually and then, you know, marrying one of the girls that he was so-called counseling and ministry. And just, it was a mess. It was a mess, all because, you know, his heart really was not loyal toward the Lord, even though he had an incredible potential. And here was Ahithophel. Now, for whatever reason, Ahithophel is doing this. You know, David refers to him in the Psalms as one who broke bread with him and was one of his closest friends. And he said, I would have been able to handle this rebellion if it had not been... If it had been an enemy who did this, but you, my close friend, we took counsel together. So David really is reeling over this. And yet, even though this thing is happening, everyone's heart is being revealed. David's true friends are coming out. Well, now, moreover, it says, Ahithophel said to Absalom, now let me choose 12,000 men, and I'll arise and pursue David tonight. I'll come upon him when he is weary, and weak, and make him afraid, and all the people who are with him will flee, and I'll strike only the king. What a unspeakable, vile, cold-hearted thing Ahithophel is doing. You know, plotting the death of David. And he says, then I'll bring all the people back to you. When all return except the man whom you seek, then all the people will be at peace. And the saying pleased Absalom and all the elders of Israel. How could you? I mean, this is your father. And yet it pleased Absalom. It appealed to his pride. It appealed to his taking control. He's got this counselor. He's aligned these people with him, and he's setting this rebellion in order. You know, it's amazing in a sense. His looking at David as the key. If you get David out of the way, then your kingdom's yours. All the other people won't matter. Kill David, and the kingdom's yours. And in a way, he's right on. He knows David. He knows he's going to be weary. He knows he's going to be brokenhearted. He knows he's going to be broken, and it's the right time to strike. And that's what David fears most, Ahithophel's counsel. Ahithophel will tell Absalom exactly what he needs to do, and this would have been the key right here. But you know what? Though people are plotting against David, and like even when they plotted against Jesus, the high priest, in antagonism toward Jesus, was arguing with the Sanhedrin who were divided over him. Some liked him. Some thought he was a threat. The high priest said, don't you understand anything? It's expedient that one man should die so the whole nation does not perish. Now, in his mind, he said, if we don't kill this guy, our nation is going to be in an uproar. We're going to have all kinds of problems with the Romans. We need to kill this one man and put those problems behind us. But what he didn't realize is that he was actually prophesying. It was expedient. It was important for Jesus to die, that the whole nation not perish, but for other reasons, that he would die for the sins of the world. And here they're plotting David's death, and yet God is going to work something else out. It's kind of like the parable Jesus told about those who were against him. He says, you know, that a master leased out his land to some tenants, and they took care of it. But when he would send a servant to collect the proceeds of it, the tenants would kill him instead of giving any money. And when after killing so many of the people he'd sent, the master says, I'm going to send my son. They'll respect my son. And they see the son and they say, come, here's the heir, let's kill him and the inheritance will be ours. And here's the same spirit at work. Let's kill David and then the kingdom will be yours. Well, then Absalom said, now call Hushai, the Archite, also. And let's hear what he says, too. Now, why? I mean, you got great counsel here. Why would he call Hushai? Except for one thing I can think. You see, the Bible says in Proverbs 21:1 that the king's heart is guided by the Lord. Though he does not know it, he probably wouldn't even ask, why did I even ask this? Except the fact the king is going to bring Absalom, or the Lord is going to bring Absalom down. And so he calls for Hushai, and when Hushai came to Absalom, Absalom spoke to him, saying, Ahithophel has spoken in this manner. Shall we do as he says, and if not, speak up? So Hushai said to Absalom, the counsel that Ahithophel has given is not good at this time. For, said Hushai, you know your father and his men, that they are mighty men, and they are enraged in their minds like a bear robbed of her cubs in the field, and your father is a man of war and will not camp with the people. Surely by now he's hidden in some pit or in some other place, and it will be when some of them are overthrown at the first that whoever hears it will say, there's a slaughter among the people who follow Absalom. Even he who is valiant, whose heart is like the heart of a lion, will melt completely. For all Israel knows that your father is a mighty man, and those who are with him are valiant men. Therefore I counsel that all Israel be fully gathered together to you from Dan to Beersheba, like the sand that is by the sea for multitude, and that you go to battle in person. So we will come upon him in some place where he may be found, and we will all fall upon him as dew falls on the ground. And of him and all the men who are with him, there shall not be one such as one left. Moreover, if he's withdrawn into a city, then all Israel shall bring ropes to that city. We'll pull it into the river till there's not one small stone found there. And so Absalom and all of the men of Israel said, the counsel of Hushai the Archite is better than the counsel of Ahithophel. Now, why did Hushai say this? Well, it's obvious. He's buying David valuable time. He knows that if they had struck David now, he won't be ready. He will not have had a chance to gather his men together and organize them and do what he needs to protect the kingdom. So he is buying David valuable time. He's hoping that his counsel will be followed so that, you know, it can be done. Well, it says, Absalom says the counsel of Hushai is better. For the Lord had purposed to defeat the good counsel of Ahithophel to the intent that the Lord might bring disaster on Absalom. You know, one thing that I learn about this is that in the councils of people who are in power, they think on the basis of their strategies and their analysis and their polls and whatever else they do to figure out what decisions they're going to make, they think they're in control. They think they've got the power. But you know, ultimately, the nations are a drop in the bucket. I look at our country today and I look at the leaders of our country and I fear for this country. I really do. I look at the scandals of our president and the many, just the rumors and all the things that are associated with his presidency and his, you know, the people he has chosen, the indictments. Never in our history have we had a president with such a record. Nixon looks like a Boy Scout in comparison. You know, and compare, it's incredible. And yet, still, the American people, it's like no big deal. He's still way up there. And I don't understand it. I don't. Except for maybe God is giving America the leaders they deserve. And I'm not saying that any other candidate is better, but I'm just saying that this is a sad place where our country is, where the leaders have gotten to such a point. We need to pray for our leaders. We need to pray seriously for those who are in power. But ultimately, God is on the throne. Ultimately, God is going to perform his will. Now we pray in this country it will not be to humble us. We pray for peace. But things are very tenuous at best. Economically, especially morally. And I think every one of us as Christians should seriously consider when we vote, to vote our conscience. Vote as God would lead us in our conscience. But God ultimately is on the throne. And Hushai said to Zadok and Abiathar the priests, thus and so Ahithophel counseled Absalom and the elders of Israel. And so this is what I've counseled, he tells them. And he says, send to David quickly, and don't spend the night in the plains of the wilderness, but cross over with speedily, lest the king and all the people who are with him be swallowed up. In other words, just in case he doesn't follow my counsel, but he changes and follows Ahithophel's, Tell David, warn him what the counsel was so he can be ready. Now Jonathan and Ahimaaz stayed at En-Rogel's, for they dared not to be seen coming into the city. So a maidservant would come and tell them, and they'd go and tell King David. So he already had his network of people. And nevertheless, a lad saw them and told Absalom. But both of them went away quickly, came to a man's house in Bahurim, who had a well in his court, and they went down into it. And the woman took and spread a covering over the well's mouth and spread some grain on it, and the thing which was not known. And when the servants came to the woman at the house, they said, "Where is Ahimaaz and Jonathan?" So they suspect they're spies. And the woman said, "Well, they went over the water brook, and when he had searched, they couldn't find him. They returned to Jerusalem. And when it came to pass, after they had departed, they came up out of the well, went and told King David, and said to David, 'Arise and cross over the water quickly, for thus has Ahithophel counseled against you.'" So just in case, you'll beware. So David and all the people who were with him arose and crossed over the Jordan by morning light. Not one of them was left who had not gone over the Jordan. So he's not going to lose one guy. Now when Ahithophel saw that his counsel was not followed, he saddled his donkey, rose and went home to his house, to his city, put his household in order, and hanged himself and died and was buried in his father's tomb. Now, there's a lot of things you could say about this. Sore loser, maybe. Maybe he saw that if his counsel wasn't followed, his days were numbered. And he knew that if he gave David time, David would eventually win, and he figures, "I don't want to meet David," so he kills himself. It could be just pure pride. My counsel wasn't followed. If I'm not respected, then I don't even need to be around. You know, whatever it might be, I think I lean toward the pride issue only because when you come to a place of hanging yourself, taking your own life into your hands, it's the ultimate act of pride. It's the ultimate act of self-determination. I will not sit here and endure any pain. I don't have to take this. I don't have to experience this suffering and this problem. I can take matters into my own hands, and ultimately it's an act of pride. Instead of humbling yourself in front of God and saying, "God, whatever you have for me, I'll be willing to endure because I know you and trust and believe you have a plan for my life." Pride. Pride is a horrible thing. And the ultimate act of pride is to take one's life. And I think that, you know, we look at society around and there's a lot of thoughts about this, you know, I mean, low self-esteem and a lot of mentality along those lines. But quite honestly, we're, you know, a person who has low self-esteem, so-called, we feel bad about ourselves, we hate ourselves type of thing. Well, you know, in reality, it's not that you hate yourself. You actually love yourself too much. If you hated yourself, you'd be happy that things were not working out for you. You know, you'd be glad that you didn't get that job. You'd be glad that people didn't like you. If you hated yourself, you'd be like, "Yeah, all right, people hate me." You know? You'd enjoy it. But because you really love yourself, you don't like it when you're not loved by others, when things don't work out for you, when things are going downhill, and ultimately self-pity comes in and low self-esteem. Again, they're all symptoms of pride. People, really, you don't have your eyes on the Lord when this is a part of your life. You're not willing to endure what He has in store for you. In pride, you know, you're frustrated with your lot. You're not willing to accept who you are and what God has made you, and to trust Him that He's got a plan for your life. Be careful. Some things are very subtle in our life. Pride is one of those things very difficult to deal with. You know, I had a severe case of self-consciousness going through high school, and when I became a Christian, it was very much a part of my life. And God had to, I had to have it identified for what it really was. Stinking pride. Self-thoughts. Thinking of me. What do people think about me? How do I feel? And when that was rooted, well, it has never been completely rooted. Flesh does never go away completely. But when God rooted a lot of that out of my life, I'll tell you what a freedom it is to not be under the tyranny of self and its dictates and its, you know, the feelings, and just to forget about yourself. What a joy that is. To be self-forgetful, pouring your life into others, there's no greater joy. I mean, I wouldn't have it any other way. I never want to go back to the misery of self-consciousness. But from time to time, when I'm conscious of a weakness or a failure, you know, I'll begin thinking about myself and get depressed, which generally you do when you think about yourself. And it's not a good place to be. Well, here's Ahithophel, the epitome. Well, David then went to Menahem, and Absalom crossed over the Jordan, he and the men of Israel with him. So now Absalom has gathered all the people together. Now, I suspect that he liked Hushai's plan because it was very much appealing to his pride. Gather all the men together. You go out to battle too, you know, the great leader that you are. Absalom, you know, Hushai knew this guy was very, you know, susceptible to people that would pump him up. You see, a wicked leader generally does not have loyal followers, because a wicked leader is in for himself, and he's only going to gather people around him like him, and they're in for themselves too. So his domain is not going to stay very long. It's not very stable. You know, when one person goes down, the other person is going to drag others, and pretty soon it's like dominoes. But where you have a good leader, you've got loyal followers who they're admiring your integrity, and they're willing to lay their life down for you. And also you have good men surrounding you who are not going to appeal to your pride. They're not going to be yes men. They're not going to give you unnecessary grief. They're going to be good, loyal friends. Tell you honestly, but back you. Boy, that's very important. Well, Absalom wasn't about to have that. So he follows the wrong counsel. And then he made Amasa captain of the army instead of Joab. Joab didn't follow or defect with Absalom. This Amasa was the son of a man whose name was Jithra, an Israelite, who had gone to Abigail. In other words, what he's saying is he seduced Abigail, the daughter of Nahash, sister of Zariah, Joab's mother. So there was kind of a little connection there, and Amasa didn't really have a great background. So Israel and Absalom encamped in the land of Gilead. And it happened when David had come to Menahem that the Shobai, the son of Nahash from Rabbah, the people of Ammon, Maker, the son of Amiel, and from Lo-Debar, and Barzillai, the Gileadite from Rogelim, brought beds and basins, earthen vessels, and wheat, barley, flour, parched grain, beans, lentils, parched seeds, honey and curds, sheep and cheese for the herd of the herd, for David and the people who were with him to eat. So he came over into the land of Gilead across the Jordan. As you're standing there in the area of the Jordan Valley, looking down in the Jordan, on the other side of the Jordan, you see the hills of Gilead. Very, very beautiful area. And that's where they're at right now, across the Jordan. And he's got friends. People are coming out to help him. So David numbered the people who were with him and set captains of thousands and captains of hundreds over them. And David sent out one-third of the people under the hand of Joab, one-third under the hand of Abishai, the son of Zariah, Joab's brother, and one-third under the hand of Ittai the Gittite. And the king said to the people, I will surely go out with you myself. But the people answered, "You will not go out. For if we flee away, they won't care about us, nor if half of us die will they care. You're worth 10,000 of us now. You're more help to us in the city." So the king said to them, Whatever seems best to you, I'll do." So it was good counsel that kept him out of it. So the king stood beside the gate, and all the people went out by hundreds and by thousands. And so David has had a chance to gather his army. He's got some great generals. He's got a strategy. He's got a plan. Hushai's counsel saved his life. The king had commanded Joab, Abishai, and Ittai, saying, "Deal gently for my sake with the young man Absalom." And all the people heard when the king gave the captain's orders concerning Absalom. So David is feeling as a father for his son. Maybe there's hope. Maybe there's a chance. So the people went out into the field of battle against Israel, and the battle was in the woods of Ephraim. This has been noted by some commentators to be an error, because Ephraim is on the other side of the Jordan. How could it be the woods of Ephraim? It's in Gilead. And some have said, oh, a contradiction, there's a problem here. Not at all. When you study your Bible, you'll go back to Judges and you'll find that there was a major battle in Gilead in which many, many, many men of Ephraim were slaughtered by Jephthah. And because of that, they quite possibly could have named that woods a memorial to Ephraim. So there's no contradiction at all. Well, the people of Israel then were overthrown there before the servants of David. A great slaughter of 20,000 men took place that day. And the battle was scattered over the face of the whole countryside, and the woods devoured more people that day than the sword devoured. And Absalom met the servants of David. Absalom rode on a mule, and the mule went under the thick boughs of a great terebinth tree, and his head caught in the terebinth, so he was left hanging between heaven and earth, and a mule was under him, went on. You get the picture. You know, he's running from these guys, looking back, probably not watching where he's going, and thud, you know. Either his head gets wedged or his hair gets caught. I suspect, I mean, it would be kind of funny to think that it shows Absalom glorying in his great length of hair and all the hair he had on his head, and it was such a treasure to him that he got tangled in this tree by his hair. That would be an interesting poetic justice. There he is hanging there. A certain man saw it and told Joab, "Hey, I just saw Absalom hanging in a terebinth tree." And Joab said to the man, "You just saw him? Why didn't you strike him to the ground? I'd given you 10 shekels of silver and a belt." Belt would have been kind of a belt of honor, of prestige. And the man said to Joab, "Though I were to receive 1,000 shekels of silver in my hand, I wouldn't raise my hand against the king's son. For in our hearing, the king commanded you and Abishai and Ittai, saying, 'Beware lest anyone touch the young man Absalom.' Otherwise, I would have dealt falsely against my own life, for there's nothing hidden from the king, and you yourself would have set yourself against me." In other words, you would have probably turned me in, and I would have had to take the rap for it. And I love this guy, man. He squares off with the general. And Joab says, "I'm not going to argue with you. I can't linger here." And he took 3 spears in his hand and thrust them through Absalom's heart while he was still alive in the midst of the terebinth tree. You know, Joab was kind of a maverick, you know. Joab did what Joab wanted to do. And since Joab was kind of in on the very initial conspiracy against Uriah, Bathsheba's husband, I think Joab always had that over David. David always wanted to get rid of Joab. He was just a fierce guy, man, killing people right and left that he didn't need to. And here he kills Absalom. However, in this instance, I have a feeling that it was good counsel or wise for him to strike Absalom. Because David, as we'll see later, was in such an emotional state as to not probably deal wisely with Absalom. And who knows how much Absalom could have eventually rallied another rebellion. Well, the 10 young men who bore Joab's armor surrounded Absalom and struck him and killed him. So the 3 darts didn't do it. He's still struggling there, so they kill him. And Joab then blew the trumpet, and the people returned from pursuing Israel, for Joab held back the people. In other words, the battle's over. Absalom's dead. The triumph of the wicked is short. When you see people in power wickedly, it's short. It's very short-lived. The Bible says the meek shall inherit the earth. One day, as you honor the Lord with your life, one day you're going to stand before Him with great reward. And you're going to rule over 10 cities if you're faithful in the little things. God will give you honor and reward as you've trusted Him. But don't fret about the wicked. Remember, sometimes, you know, you look at the prosperity of the wicked and you think, man, these guys are ripping people off and yet they're making it successfully. You know, they're getting ahead. They're getting their houses and their cars and their boats and they're living fat, easy lives. It's not fair. I'm serving God and it's tough. No, one day, I can wait. My reward is in heaven. I'm not looking to get my reward here on earth. Although, to be honest with you, as Jesus said, it's the reward is here on earth. I mean, He gives me many, many more times in true blessings of life. Family and friends, co-workers, and seeing Him work and being used of Him is a joy that can't be described. Much more valuable than playing with toys. All the things this world can accumulate. You can only play with so many toys at one time, and then you get bored with them anyway. People are what make life exciting. People are where it's at. Investing your life in people. Having an impact for good. The triumph of the wicked is short. Well, they took Absalom, cast him into a large pit in the woods, and laid a very large heap of stones over him, and all Israel fled, everyone to his tent, because they knew what the king commanded, so they're kind of scattering. Let's get out of here quick. So Absalom in his lifetime had taken to set a pillar for himself. Why am I not surprised? Which is in the king's valley. For he said, I have no son to keep my name in remembrance. And he called the pillar after his own name. And to this day it's called Absalom's Monument. Now there is a monument today that's called Absalom's Pillar in the, not at the Kidron Valley, but around the southern end of the city of David. You're walking on the wall, as you walk on the rampart there, you can look down and see Absalom's Pillar. The unfortunate thing is it's not, obviously it's a, a 5th or 6th century erection on the site. So it's not the actual pillar that Absalom, it could very well be on the spot. And there is certainly, they found tombs in the area and they found other monuments, so that's very probable it's on the spot. Generally, you know, when the during the Byzantine period, they would find certain things and they build monuments on them and call them after the names that they suspected were traditionally the site. So it's very possible it's the site. Well, Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok, said, let me run now and take the news to the king how the Lord has avenged him of his enemies. So here's this guy, he wants to bring the good news. And Joab said, you shall not take the news this day, for you shall take the news another day. But today you shall take no news, because the king's son is dead. In other words, I don't want to send you, a good guy, you know, to bring the news. He'll look at you and say, oh, good news. And then hear the son, he's going to be mad. And maybe Joab remembers of how David just took the life of those guys who claimed to take Saul's life. And he thought David might fly off in a rage and kill this good guy. So he tries to save him. No, I'll send somebody else. I'll send somebody that's dispensable. So Joab said to the Cushite, go tell what the king you have seen. So the Cushite bowed himself to Joab and ran. And Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok, said to Joab, but whatever happens, please let me run after the Cushite. And Joab says, well, why will you run, my son, since you have no news ready? Now, that's a Hebrew phrase that it's really not easy to understand. It could be, since you really haven't heard the full picture, or it could be that, you know, the news that you've got is not appropriate for you to bring. Or, you know, there's something vague there. But whatever happens, he says, let me run. So Joab says, all right, then run. So Ahimaaz ran by the way of the plain and outran the Cushite. Though David was sitting between the two gates, the watchman went up on the roof over the gate. The wall lifted his eyes and looked. There was a man running alone, and the watchman cried out and says, hey. The king said, if he's alone, there's news in his mouth. And he came rapidly and drew near. In other words, if there was a bunch of guys running, he'd be, not good in the battle front. We're losing men. But one guy coming was like a messenger. So the watchman saw another man running. The watchman called to the gatekeeper and says, there's another man running alone. And the king says, he also brings news, I suspect. You know. And the watchman said, I think the running of the first is like the running of Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok. So this guy must have been a speedster. He outran the guy, even though starting later. And the king said, he's a good man and comes with good news. And Ahimaaz called out and said to the king, all is well. And he bowed down with his face to the earth before the king and said, blessed be the Lord your God, who has delivered up the men who raised their hand against my lord the king. So he wanted to bring the good news. The king said, is the young man Absalom safe? And Ahimaaz answered, when Joab sent the king's servant to me, your servant, I saw a great tumult, but I didn't know what it was about. Now either he's lying and does not want to be to tell him the bad news, or he really didn't know. I suspect he just didn't want to tell him. You know, so he just says, well, I'm not really sure. Well, the king said to the... Then the Cushite came. He said, turn aside and be still. And the Cushite came and he said, good news, my lord. The Lord has avenged you this day of all those who rose against you. And the king said to the Cushite, is the young man Absalom safe? The Cushite answered, may the enemies of my lord, the king, and all who rise against you to do you harm be as that young man is. Well, the king was deeply moved and went up to the chamber over the gate and wept. And as he went, he said thus, oh, my son Absalom, my son Absalom, if only I had died in your place. Oh, Absalom, my son, my son. You know, David is still reeling over his own sin, knowing that this is part of the discipline. He feels responsible for his son. He feels it's his fault. Well, Joab told, behold, the king. He was told the king was weeping and mourning for Absalom. The victory that day then was turned into mourning for all the people. For the people heard it was said, the king is grieved for his son. And the people stole back into the city that day as people who are ashamed steal back when they flee in battle. The king covered his face, and the king cried out with a loud voice, "Oh, my son Absalom, my son, oh, my son." And Joab came into the house to the king and said, "Today you have disgraced your servants who have saved your life and the lives of your sons and daughters, the lives of your wives and the lives of your concubines, in that you love your enemies and hate your friends. For you have declared today that you neither regard princes nor servants, for today I perceive if Absalom had lived and all of us had died today, then it would have pleased you well. Now therefore arise, go out and speak comfort to your servants, for I swear by the Lord, if you do not go out, not one will stay with you this night, and that will be worse for you than all the evil that has befallen you from your youth until now." I have to hand it to Joab, he's absolutely right. You know, the people have come back risking their own lives, and now all David cares about is his son Absalom, and his son Absalom was ready to kill him in a moment. Justice had to be done. This is inordinate affection. Indulging Absalom from the very beginning, not disciplining him when he killed Amnon, arguing with what God has decided and frustrated over that and not caring about his own people, David's very foolish here. But thankfully, he listens to the counsel of Joab. And the king arose and sat in the gate, and they told the people, saying, "There is a king sitting in the gate." So all the people came before the king, for every one of Israel had fled to his tent. So they've come, they've basically, you know, starting now to restore the kingdom. People, however, were in a dispute throughout the tribes of Israel, saying, "The king saved us from the hand of our enemies. He delivered us from the hand of the Philistines, and now he's fled from the land because of Absalom. But Absalom, whom he anointed over us, has died in battle. Now, therefore, why do you say nothing about bringing back the king?" And King David sent to Zadok and Abiathar the priest, saying, "Speak to the elders of Judah." Now, that's his tribe. Saying, "Why are you the last to bring the king back to his house, since the words of all Israel have come to the king, even to his house? You are my brother, and you are my bone and my flesh. Why are then you the last to bring back the king? And say to Amasa, are you not at my bone and my flesh?" He realizes the relationship there. He says, "God do so meet to me, and more also, if you're not commander of the army before me continually in place of Joab." So he's, as much as Joab has done in a bad way, David's ready to replace him. So he basically tells Amasa, "Look, join with me, you can be my commander." So he swayed the hearts of the men of Judah, just as the heart of one man, so that they sent this word to the king, "Return, you and all your servants." And the king returned and came to the Jordan, and Judah came to Gilgal to go to meet the king, to escort the king across the Jordan. So I love David. He doesn't just walk right in and take over. He really wants to know whether they want him. He does that. And he tells Amasa, "Hey, you know, I'm not going to hold it against you." He's being very gracious. Shimei, the son of Gera, a Benjamite who was from Bahurim, hastened and came down with the men of Judah to meet King David. Remember what he did. He was there throwing rocks at David, cursing him when he was leaving. Now he's coming down and bowing down before him, and there are 1,000 men of Benjamin with him, and Ziba, the servant of the house of Saul, and his 15 sons and his 20 servants with him, and they went over the Jordan before the king. So he's got all these people together. He's kind of like, "I better make up." And a ferry boat went across to carry over the king's household and all that he thought good, to do what he thought good. And Shimei, the son of Gera, fell down before the king when he had crossed the Jordan. And he said to the king, "Do not let my lord impute iniquity to me, or remember the wrong your servant did on the day my lord left Jerusalem, that the king should take it to heart. For I, your servant, know that I have sinned. Therefore, here I am, the first to come today of all the house of Joseph to go down to meet my lord the king." But Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, answered and said, "Shall not Shimei be put to death for this, because he cursed the Lord's anointed?" And David said, "What have I to do with you, son of Zeruiah, that you shall be adversaries with me today? Shall any man be put to death today in Israel? For do I not know that today I am king over Israel?" And therefore the king said to Shimei, "You shall not die." And the king swore to him. Later, however, on his dying bed, he tells Solomon, "You know what Shimei did to me. You just deal with him wisely." And Solomon gives him a chance, tells him he can't leave Jerusalem, and if he does, his own life will be in forfeit. And Shimei loses a few servants, goes out after them, comes back. Solomon finds out and says, "Sorry, dude, gave you a chance. Now you're dead. You killed him." So Shimei really, you know, he did blow it majorly. David was not about to lift his hand against him. But he did. David did want justice. And so Shimei was given an honest chance. And then Mephibosheth, the son of Saul, came down to meet the king. And he had not cared for his feet nor trimmed his mustache, washed his clothes from the day the king departed until the day he came back in peace. And it was when he came to Jerusalem to meet the king said to him, "Why did you not go with me, Mephibosheth?" Remember the son of Jonathan, who, the son of Saul, who, you know, was lame in his feet. David showed mercy to him for the sake of Jonathan. And he says, "My lord, O king, my servant deceived me. For your servant said, 'I'll saddle a donkey for myself that I may ride on it and go to the king, because your servant is lame.' And he has slandered your servant to my lord the king, but my lord the king is like an angel of God. Therefore do what is good in your eyes. For all of my father's house were but dead men before my lord the king, yet you set your servant among those who eat at your own table. Therefore what right have I to still cry out to the king any more?" So the king said to him, "Why do you speak any more of your matters? I have said you and Ziba divide the land." Now this is kind of indefinitive, but it's almost like looking forward to some wisdom here. He's just testing, I believe, Mephibosheth's heart here. I say, "Well, I don't care what you say. You know, you guys divide the land, you work it out. I don't really know what the truth is." And then Mephibosheth said to the king, "Rather let him take it all, inasmuch as my lord the king has come back in peace to his own house." I believe at this point David knew Mephibosheth was loyal, and I believe he restored to Mephibosheth those lands. Does not say, doesn't go any farther, but it kind of reminds me of the judgment that Solomon later on is going to make. Remember when the two ladies come? And one, there's a child in the one hand of the lady, and she says, "This is my child." And the other lady says, "No, that's my child. You rolled over on your son in the middle of the night, and he was killed, and you replaced your dead son with my living son, and that's my child." And so Solomon had this judgment to make. So he said, "Okay, give me a sword. Divide the child in half. Give one half to this lady, one half to that lady." Well, at that point, the mother of the child said, no, please don't harm him. Let her have him." And the other woman said, "No, that's fair. Divide him." I don't know why she said that. It's kind of stupid. She might have probably said it before. She said, "Well, that's fair." And the other one cried out and yearned for her son. Well, Solomon knew immediately who was the real mother. And I think here David must have known that Mephibosheth was loyal, as he says, "Hey, he doesn't even care about the lands." Well, Barzillai the Gileadite came down from Rogelim, went across the Jordan with the king to escort him across the Jordan. And Barzillai was a very aged man, 80 years old. He provided the king with supplies while he stayed at Menahem, for he was a very rich man. And the king said to Barzillai, "Come across with me, and I'll provide for you while you're in Jerusalem." And Barzillai said to the king, "How long do I have to live that I should go up to the king, with the king to Jerusalem? Today I'm 80 years old. Can I discern between good and bad? Can your servant taste what I eat or what I drink? Can I hear any longer the voice of singing men and singing women? Why should your servant be a further burden to my lord the king? Your servant will go a little way across the Jordan with the king, but why should the king repay me with such a reward? Please let your servant turn back, that I may die in my own city and be buried by the grave of my father and mother. But here is your servant Chimham. Let him cross over with my lord the king and do for him what seems good to you." So a relative here, perhaps his son, perhaps a very faithful servant, we don't really know. The king answered, "Chimham shall cross over with me, and I will do for him what seems good to you. Now whatever you request of me, I'll do for you." And all the people went over the Jordan, and when the king had crossed over, the king kissed Barzillai and blessed him, and he returned to his own place. And the king went on to Gilgal, and Chimham went on with him, and all the people of Judah escorted the king, and also half the people of Israel. Just then the men of Israel came to the king and said to the king, "Why have our brethren, the men of Judah, stolen you away and brought the king, his household, and all David's men with him across the Jordan?" So all the men of Judah answered the men of Israel, "Because the king is a close relative of ours. Why are you angry over this matter? Have we ever eaten the king's expense? Has he given us any gift?" And the men of Israel answered the men of Judah and said, "We have 10 shares in the king. Therefore we have more right to David than you. Why do some of you despise us as if we were we not the first to advise bringing back our king?" Yet the words of the men of Judah were fiercer than the words of the men of Israel. Now, what's happening here? Everybody's like vying for position. And the tribal battles are only increasing. You know, wherever you have people together, you're going to have controversy. You're going to have hurt feelings. You're going to have, he said, she said, I want, they want. You're going to have a little competition. It's unfortunate, but it's human nature. Lord has to root this out of us, though, especially in the ministry. You can't have a part. You can't have this attitude. You've got to be rather willing, as Paul says, to be defrauded rather than take matters to the courts and try to settle them there with your brother or your sister. It's just not worth it. Well, because of this dispute, out of this little tiny dispute, a split arises. There was a rebel whose name was Sheba, the son of Berki, a Benjamite. He blew a trumpet and said, "We have no part in David, nor do we have inheritance in the son of Jesse. Every man to his tents, O Israel." So the Judah won the argument, but Israel huffs off and wants to go off on their own. So every man of Israel deserted David and followed Sheba, the son of Bichri, but the men of Judah from the Jordan as far as Jerusalem remained loyal. Now David came to his house at Jerusalem. The king then took the 10 women, his concubines, whom he had left to keep the house, put them in seclusion and supported them, but didn't go into them. Those were the ones that Absalom went into. So they were shut up to the day of their death, living in widowhood. And the king said to Amasa, "Assemble the men of Judah with me for within 3 days, and be present there yourself." So Amasa went to assemble the men of Judah, but he delayed longer than the set time which David had appointed him. For whatever reason, Amasa had connections with Israel, and he wasn't that quick to go and start a fight with his own people. He's delaying. He's not listening to the king. He's not really being faithful. And whether David should have ever put this guy in charge or not is very doubtful. And here a guy was just loyal to Absalom, who was trying to kill David, and now he's David's general. I don't think it was wise. David's graciousness sometimes went too far. But Amasa then went to assemble the men, but he delayed, and then David said to Abishai, "Now Sheba the son of Bichri will do us more harm than Absalom. Take your Lord's servants, pursue him, lest he find for himself fortified cities and escape us." So he sends another general on the job. And Joab's men then went with the Cherethites, the Pelethites, and all the mighty men went out after him. Abishai, the brother of Joab's in charge, but Joab went with him, and since they're Joab's men, Joab, found a way to worm his way back in there, And when they were at the large stone, which is in Gibeon, Amasa came before them, and Joab was dressed in battle armor, and on it was a belt with a sword fastened in its sheath at his hips. And as he was going forward, it fell out. And Joab said to Amasa, "Are you in health, my brother?" And Joab took Amasa by the beard and with his right hand to kiss him, but Amasa didn't notice the sword that was in Joab's hand, and he struck him with it in the stomach, and his entrails poured out on the ground. And he didn't strike him again. Thus he died. And Joab and Abishai's brother pursued Sheba, the son of Bichri. Meanwhile, one of Joab's men stood near Amasa and said, "Whoever favors Joab and whoever is for David, let him follow Joab." But Amasa wallowed in his blood in the middle of the highway. And when the men saw the people stood still, and he moved Amasa from the highway to the field and threw a garment over him, when he saw that everyone came upon him, halted. I mean, you're a soldier in the army. You're following Amasa and you're walking along and there's your general dead by the road. It's like, what happened? So everyone stopped figuring this out, and then they finally put him out of the way and they're following Joab, who kind of took over. Joab was a tough guy. I think David was afraid of Joab. I think it's very possible. He was a tough character. When he was removed from the highway, all the people went on after Joab to pursue Sheba and the son of Bichri. Now, later, I just want you to know, Joab is definitely going to get justice. But looking at this, he seems to be getting away with a lot. Well, when he went through all the tribes of Israel to Abel and Beth-Maacah and all the Berethites, they were gathered together and also went after Sheba. And they came and besieged him in Abel of Beth-Maacah, and they cast up a siege mound against the city and stood by the rampart, and all the people who were with Joab battered the wall to throw it down. So they're going after this one guy. And a wise woman cried from the city, "Hear, hear, please say to Joab, come nearby me that I may speak with you." And when he had come near to her, the woman said, "Are you Joab?" And he said, "I am." And she said to him, "Hear the words of your maidservant." He says, "I'm listening." So she spoke, saying, "They used to talk in former times, saying, they shall surely ask counsel of Abel, and so they would end disputes. I'm among the peaceable and faithful in Israel. You seek to destroy a city and a mother in Israel. Why would you swallow up the inheritance of the Lord?" And Joab answered and said, far be it from me that I should swallow up or destroy. This is not so. But a man from the mountains of Ephraim, Sheba, the son of Bichri by name, has raised his hand against the king, against David. Deliver him only, and I'll depart from the city. And the woman said to Joab, watch, his head will be thrown to you over the wall. So the woman in her wisdom went to all the people, and they cut off the head of Sheba, the son of Bichri, and threw it out to Joab. And he blew a trumpet, and they withdrew from the city, and every man to his tent. So Joab returned to the king at Jerusalem. So the Lord used a wise woman in that city to save everybody's life, because that guy would have brought everybody down. And then Joab was over the army of Israel. He got right back in there. Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, was over the Cherethites and the Pelethites, and Adoram was in charge of the revenue. Jehoshaphat, the son of Ahilud, was recorder. Sheba the scribe, Zadok and Abiathar the priests, and Ira the Jerite was chief minister under David. So basically the historian is telling us things are in order now. David has his kingdom in order, and the rebellion is done. Things are back on track. But what a cost. I think there's tremendous lessons in these passages for leaders especially. Watch out that you don't have that heart like Absalom, thinking of yourself first, because you'll be set up by your own pride and you'll fall. Pride goes before the fall. David had to take his licks, but I admire David and his patience and waiting on God and giving God the opportunity to do his work. You know, it's a bloody thing to look at all these battles and see the violence and all the garbage that's going on because of people that took up the sword very, very quickly against one another. You know, you and I can also take up a sword, maybe not physically, but we can. One of the things that I find destroys people almost equally is our tongue. How we have to be careful with that little piece of flesh in between our nose and our chin. That little muscle, as James tells us, it boasts great things. It's just a little tiny thing, but just like a rudder on a ship, it can steer the whole ship. Just a little thing, like a little match, can set a whole forest on fire. And how we can destroy people with our tongue. For whatever, we have the same motives that they have, the bitterness or the envy or the pride, and those same things will attack us. We're human too. And we're not going to go pick up a sword because we know we'll probably go to jail. In that culture, it was different. You know, you settled matters with the sword. You settled personal vengeances. You settled justice with the sword. Everything was settled with the sword. That wasn't obviously God's choice, but he was dealing with the people according to their culture, as to what they could receive. Our culture, more sophisticated, yes, but equally deadly. How we have to be careful. You know, we can undermine people so easily. You meet someone in the church, and maybe you just don't hit it off with them. Well, do you have to tell 5 or 10 other people that you just don't like that person? You don't like the way they look? Why they talk or whatever it is. I mean, think about it. How much damage we do to people's reputations with our tongue. You know, I think it's so wise to watch. And this is probably one of the greatest tests for anyone in ministry, is how gracious they are toward others. I'm always very watchful of how a person refers to another person that they may not like. Are they gracious? Are they vindictive? You know, those things are very important. Lord, help us to be gracious. Because, you know, when we're gracious, the Lord will fight our battles if there's a battle to be fought. He'll take care of us. You know, I like people who are peacemakers. You know, this one guy who knew that there was a real strife between two people in the church. Such a strife that it actually caused one person not to come to the church anymore. And he was out in his field and he just was so mad at this other guy in the church that he didn't want to go back. He just couldn't stand him for some discussion or misunderstanding that they had. Well, this one brother who knew both of them went to the one guy and said, you know, you don't like so-and-so very much, do you? Oh, that slime, you better believe that he's such a lying thief. And this guy's... And the guy goes, wait a second. I mean, he may be all those things, but you got to admit one thing. He definitely is a good family man. He takes care of his family. He's faithful in that area. And Guy goes, yeah, well, so what of it? I guess he is a good family man. Well, then the friend went to the other guy. And he says, you don't like so-and-so, do you? He goes, oh, that he's a liar and a thief. He talks bad of, you know, and he starts going on. He says, wait a minute, you got to admit one thing. That though he is that way, I mean, he has been very good in serving the church. He's been very faithful. And by the way, do you know he said something of you the other day? That he said you're a good family man. He did? Really? I guess he has been a good servant in the church, you know. So the man went back to the other guy and says, you know, I was talking to so-and-so the other day. I know you don't like him, but he thinks you were a really good servant in the church. He said that? Yeah. Eventually he got these two guys together and they worked over their differences. Now the funny thing is to me is that, you know, you can always see, even in disagreements and difficulties with people, you can always see something to build upon. I sometimes get a kick out of, you know, in certain situations with marriage counseling, when husband and wife is just ready to tear each other's throats out. And, you know, I'm sitting there watching them and I kind of laugh, you know, and they look at me like, what am I laughing about? And I say, you guys don't see it, do you? I says, yeah, you're having a struggle over these things and these are very important to you, but don't you see God has put you together? That you need each other more than you realize? Look, at the very thing that you don't like about each other is the very, you're strong in this, you're strong in that, come together. And you know, I like to see how you can see people put together, even though maybe naturally they wouldn't think that way. But there's always a way. Blessed are the peacemakers. But watch the tongue. You can either bless people incredibly with it or you can bring people down. What do you want to be known for? You want to be known for Joab, always sticking a sword in somebody's gut? Always worried about himself, and if anybody else gets one over on him, he'll take care of them. Being very vindictive, or would you rather be David, who's just willing, hey, if Shimei's going to curse me, maybe God has called him to curse me. He's willing to endure it. You know, some very good lessons.